Right now, it is time to bring in Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. It is time to talk food with Arthur, as we do on Monday morning at this time. And Arthur, I want to start off by saying good morning. And I made a mistake yesterday that turned out very, very good.
Oh, that's a good thing. What happened?
I wanted to make pea soup, so I had gone to the store, and I thought I purchased a bunch of, you know, ham hocks. You know what I mean? I took them out yesterday. They weren't. They were bone marrow bones.
So they were just marrow bones.
Yeah, so what I did is I took four or five of them, put them in a big pot of water, and just let them cook down. And I chopped up some potato, carrots, celery, onions, carrots, and of course, the marrow floated around and let it very low heat for like 3 hours. Arthur, it was amazing.
I'm bone broth. You made bone broth.
It was amazing.
And you pay a fortune for it nowadays in the supermarket in a box, and I'm sure it was nowhere near as good as yours.
It was amazing. So, that's my story.
Listen, do you have any left over?
Yes.
Well, I think that would freeze very well.
And,
you know, with the weather the way it is, it's nice to have something like that in the freezer on a day where you don't really want to go out.
Yeah.
A lot of days like that here. We had 1 hour of gorgeous snow about 8 o'clock last night, and then it turned into torrential rain with the loudest wind I've heard in years.
Yeah, we've got about anywhere, depending where you are in our immediate area, 3.5 to 5 inches of snow and sleet that's on the ground. But you're right, the wind was absolutely amazing this morning. Absolutely amazing.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I woke up this morning not knowing what I was going to talk about. I've been cooking all week, of course, because here I am stuck in the house. And also I've discovered Whole Foods delivery. Don't ask. And whoever shops there, I always complain. When I'm in the store, I complain about these shoppers because they clog up the aisles. But now that I'm utilizing these shoppers, I'm very respectful. They are doing great shopping for me. Anyway, I didn't know what I was going to do this today until I got on Facebook, where I sometimes get inspiration from. I always say the only misinformation I get on Facebook is the wrong pan size or oven temperature. Because almost all of my Facebook friends are cooks, and they report on and photograph their food, or other people's food. So this morning, I don't know where this came from, but all of a sudden, there was Lori Colwin's oven-fried chicken. This is a recipe I've made several times. I've changed it over the years. But it's not really a revolutionary recipe. I think all of our grandmothers or aunts, somebody in our family made oven-fried chicken. My Aunt Pauline, my great-aunt Pauline in Baltimore, was the best oven-fried chicken maker in my family, and I have her recipe, and it's also totally standard. It's made with crushed cornflakes. This one, however, the only thing different... Lori has this wonderful recipe. The thing that's different about it is you bake it at a 350-degree oven for 2 hours. Coated heavily, heavily, heavily with Dijon mustard, breadcrumbs, and butter. What could be bad? The mustard, if you really slather it on heavily, keeps the chicken moist, even though you're cooking it for 2 hours. That's a change I've made. I do not cook my chicken for 2 or even 2.5 hours, as some people do. I think an hour and a half is more than enough. Depends on the size of the chicken pieces. By the way, online somebody commented, "Oh well, maybe she cooks it that long because she's making so much chicken." If you're making a sheet pan full of chicken, it doesn't really matter if it's 2 pounds or 6 pounds. The chicken itself, in pieces, drumsticks, legs, breasts, whatever you have, is still going to cook in the same time. So that's nonsense. Anyway, that got me going, and I remembered that when I was the food editor at the Daily News, for a number of years, we ran a two-part food section. Now, the food section at the Daily News, we're talking about the 1980s, was like a small food magazine every week. We had I had 38 to 42 pages to fill up. Of course, a lot of it was advertising, and the job of the editor was to fill in, basically. As far as the company was concerned, my job was to fill in the spaces between the ads. So anyway, we ran a section called "You Can Never Have Too Many Chicken Recipes." And then the next week we would have parts, comma, two, T-O-O, which, by the way, was a triple pun because the section itself, which was called Good Living, was also known as part two. So we had parts also, you know, parts two. So this morning, after I must have at least four or five, I didn't count, four or five oven-baked fried chicken. They call it fried chicken. It's not. They're all the same. You season the chicken any which way. You cover it with something that's going to make breadcrumb stick. In this, in Lori Colvin's case, it's mustard, but you could dip it in egg. You could dip it in egg white only. You could dip it in milk, unless you're kosher. And then you dredge it in breadcrumbs. Or these days, people use panko breadcrumbs, which do come out crunchier than regular breadcrumbs. I do not like commercial breadcrumbs because if you look at the label, it's going to have sugar in it. Panko has sugar in it. That's why they come out so crispy. And if you have an old recipe that called for normal breadcrumbs and you're now making it with the panko breadcrumbs or some of the commercial products that also, you mean like, you know, name brands that come in canisters, they also have sugar. So I use bakery-made breadcrumbs from the same bread I would make it from myself. In fact, I have a loaf of bread right here that's drying out so I can make some more breadcrumbs. So those breadcrumbs definitely need some lubrication to become crisp. So you either dot the chicken with butter or drizzle oil over it or drizzle melted butter over it or, my favorite, which is to mix the breadcrumbs ahead of time with some butter, melted butter, and then dredge the chicken in the already buttered breadcrumbs. You put it on a baking sheet, you stick it in a 400-degree oven, and it's going to be done in an hour, maybe even a little less. I make plain baked chicken all the time. It's like my go-to thing. Oh, I'm too lazy to cook, but I'm never too lazy to put salt and pepper on some chicken pieces and stick them in the oven. And my rule is the chicken thighs, or even a whole chicken, which I'll get to in a second, 40 minutes at 450 degrees on the top shelf of the oven. I say top shelf because you get radiated heat from the top of the oven, and that helps the chicken get brown. I don't need my chicken to be, you know, like brown, brown, brown. As long as the skin has been crisped up and browned, I'm happy. I salt, pepper, brush the skin side with olive oil. That's all I do. I mean, you can use regular peanut oil, canola oil, any oil. I just happen to like the olive oil. And I serve it with lemon wedges. It's delicious. And then you can have any vegetable you want on the side. The other day we had those ketogenic cauliflower mashed potatoes. It's cauliflower, but, you know, it looks like mashed potatoes. You know, if you're craving mashed potatoes, it'll do. It was very, very good to go with the chicken, got to say. But I most often, I rarely buy rotisserie chickens. Around the corner, there's a supermarket that sells, I have to say, as good a rotisserie chicken as you're probably going to get. But to me, that's not good enough because invariably, the breast meat is overcooked. The chickens have delicious thighs and drumsticks. I can cut off the wings and enjoy them. But the breasts themselves are not my thing. So they're almost always, as I say, overcooked. So I spatchcock my chicken, which is a fancy word being used these days. Means nothing more than butterfly the chicken. To do this, I have one of those very, very good kitchen shears that cut right through chicken bones. I cut out the backbone, just go along the back, start at the tushy, you know, that's where the back is, and on either side, and now you have don't throw out the backbone. That's my treat, by the way. I put that on the roasting pan or on the baking sheet. And the rest of the chicken, I press down on the breast so to flatten it all out so it's not all curved. The whole point here is to have a butterfly chicken that's laying relatively flat on your roasting pan or baking sheet. Salt, pepper, both sides. I do that heavily, both sides. Brush the top with oil. Again, 450 degrees, top shelf of the oven, 40 minutes, maybe 45 minutes, depends on the size of the chicken. I always go for smaller chickens. We're only two people, plus I like the way they cook. But it's hard to get a chicken that's under 4 pounds these days, 3.5 pounds, 4 pounds. I would take 45 minutes, even 50 minutes with this butterfly chicken. And that's it. And a 4 pound chicken is way more than we can eat. So we eat the dark meat, the wings, the legs and thighs as one meal, and then I save the breast, as I would with the rotisserie chicken, too. I save the breast for another meal, do a number of things. We could just have, for that matter, sliced white meat chicken with some coleslaw and, you know, sort of salad plate. That's always good. Now, another thing that I do a lot with chicken is make chicken mole. Another super easy thing to do if you have mole paste. Now, I'm a fortunate man. I have a lady who makes mole paste and sells me these pint containers for $9. It's like nothing, because that pint container is at least three meals for Bob and me. So what you do is you take your chicken parts, whatever parts you like. If you like breasts, this is a good one for you. Put them in a deep skillet, a saute pan, you know, straight-sided deep skillet, and cover them just with water. And then I put in a couple of crushed cloves of garlic, crushed with just the heel of my hand, smashed cloves of garlic, some salt, not a lot. And you don't need pepper, and simmer the chicken parts until they're done, which takes at least a half an hour, maybe 40 minutes, depends on the parts. When they're done, you know, when they're just cooked, remove them from the pan, and now you have a really delicious chicken broth. And you put now I usually figure for my, you know, I have, let's say, 4 to 6 pieces of chicken, I'm using about 2 cups, a little bit more maybe, of water to cover. Depends on your pan, too, and the chicken pieces, but more or less. And now you have chicken broth to which you will add mole paste. Now, mole paste is something you can actually buy in the supermarket. I've checked. There are various brands out there. Which is the best? I have no idea. It's very time-consuming. Not hard, but very, very time-consuming to make mole paste. It's nuts. Yes, chocolate is in there, too. Garlic, chilies. I mean, a lot of ingredients. Go look up online to make mole. You know, there are many moles, too. The one that I use is Oaxacan. It's from Oaxaca, which is famous for mole. And the lady that I buy it from, she's not from Oaxaca, but she says she makes Oaxacan-style mole, dark mole. So you put in, you know, a good, I would say, 3/4 cup of mole paste. That's probably a jar. It comes in jars in the supermarket. Into your water, and let it simmer for a few minutes. The mole paste will, the word they use is bloom, like a flower. It'll bloom. And it will, after a bit, thicken the broth to quite a thick sauce. And when you get a nice consistency in your sauce, it doesn't take more than 10 minutes or so, put the chicken back in and let it simmer in the sauce for a few more minutes. You know, it won't get overcooked. Or you can just put it in the hot mole sauce, cover the pan, and when you're ready to eat it later that day, my case. I cook early and I eat late. You just reheat it a little bit. Now, what to eat that with is, to me, you got to have some tortilla to mop up the mole, but you could have it with rice. It's delicious, too, your rice and beans. I always need a green vegetable, so I do some kind of, usually a sautéed green with that. So yeah, or salad, or just a salad is good. So that would be another chicken dish. Now, I mean, I can't go through my entire repertoire of chicken dishes because there are too many. As I say, you can never have too many chicken recipes, parts two. It was funny because when I came up with that sort of idea of parts two, parts were a sort of novelty. We're talking the 1980s, the early 1980s. Chicken had not been broken down into the many forms it is now. For instance, you couldn't buy ground chicken. That didn't exist in the supermarket. Chickens were broiler fryers, which meant that they were under 3 pounds, usually 2.5 pounds. You can't find it's hard, really hard to find a 2.5 pound chicken now. And buying chicken by the parts was a relatively new thing. And chicken was cheap, very cheap. It is still, I suppose, the cheapest of the animal proteins, although pork is pretty cheap these days, too. But certainly, I don't know, I'm eating more chicken, not so much because it's affordable, but because everything else has gotten so expensive and it just looks so tempting. So one of the things that I'm going to, I mean, looking through my files this morning of chicken, and I have, as I said, way too many chicken recipes. I can never make them all. But one came out. We love the combination of chicken and lemon in many different ways. And there's a recipe in my, I think this recipe, I haven't, didn't even look. I think this recipe made it into New York City food, into my sort of history of, well, it's called an opinionated history with legendary recipes. And at one time, one of the legendary restaurants in New York was El Parador. El Parador was my first Mexican restaurant. And it was on 34th Street, like between 1st and 2nd, 2nd and 3rd. I remember it being right off the FDR. And it's an interesting story. This recipe is for their signature dish, their chicken El Parador, which in the end is sort of nothing but a marinated chicken fried and then topped with a vinaigrette. And I really like this in its day, as did Craig Claiborne, the then food editor of the New York Times. He published this recipe more than once, including in one of his cookbooks, one of the New York Times cookbooks. But El Parador is an interesting story because the cooks at El Parador were Chinese. And what's ironic about that is you couldn't find a Mexican in New York to cook Mexican food in those days. You had to hire Chinese chefs to cook Mexican. Nowadays, we have Mexican chefs cooking Chinese. So we have Mexican chefs cooking everything in New York. If we didn't have Mexican chefs in New York, we would have no restaurants. They're not all dishwashers by a long shot. Anyway, you ask in your Italian restaurant who's making the carbonara, and his name is likely to be Hernandez. So what's ironic about this place is that El Parador finally closed in like 1990, or it didn't close, but it was sold by the original owners, and forget it, it was over in 1990. And certainly the Chinese cooks did not like working for their new boss, so a lot of them left and opened, and since they had been cooking Mexican food for years, they opened up the Fresco Tortilla Grill. Have you ever heard of the Fresco? I think they're still all over the place. There's one here in Park Slope, and they just make tacos. And they make their own tortillas. The whole deal here was that these Mexican chefs from El Parador knew about this because they cooked Mexican food, they knew about this machine that you could buy, and they bought one. I think, if I remember, it came from Texas. And you put, you know, you make your dough for the tortillas, and you put it in one end of the machine, and out comes a baked tortilla on the other end, not just rolled in the perfect shape, but actually baked. It's like a conveyor belt, an oven on a conveyor belt. So they stuffed the tortillas we used to call them soft taco. Now you say taco, you mean soft taco. But back in the 80s, what did we know? There were no taquerias in New York in the 1980s. They also made quesadillas at the Fresco Tortilla place. I used to go to the one on Lexington Avenue and 23rd Street, but eventually they opened all over the place, and there were these Mexican taco places where the chefs were Chinese. And by the way, the thing that I loved so much about these places is they made very, very good roasted meat, including chicken, roast chicken. And because they were Chinese, they would have these big Chinese chopping blocks, and they would chop up the chicken to order with a Chinese cleaver. Mexicans don't use Chinese cleavers. So that chicken dish, by the way, the marinade is good. And I always use this in pieces, not a whole chicken. But the marinade is 3 tablespoons of oil, a couple, I would say more than a couple, let's say 4 cloves of garlic crushed with the heel of your hand, a bay leaf. I break it into pieces in this case, but not into little pieces because then you get stuck in your throat. A nice amount of oregano. I would say a couple of rounded teaspoons of dried oregano, a teaspoon of salt, a whole teaspoon of pepper, and of course El Parador back in those days used MSG. We're going to leave out the MSG. And that's it. You mix all those ingredients up. You put your chicken pieces in a plastic bag. You pour that in. You cover and refrigerate it. It's better if you do it overnight, but you can do it just for a few hours if you want. And then the dressing, as I said, we always like these acidic toppings to our chicken, lemon juice. It could just be a squeeze of lemon juice. But in this case, you make a full-blown vinaigrette, 3 tablespoons of oil, 1/2 teaspoon of minced garlic, 3 tablespoons of wine vinegar. I've been buying, by the way, a wine vinegar that has 12% acidity. I really like this because of the high acidity. Usually, vinegar is way less than that. It could be even 4%, like rice wine vinegar. So if you can buy a high acidity red wine vinegar, or white wine vinegar for that matter, like 7%, get it. It means less liquid for the same amount of acidity. In the case of this vinaigrette, I would even go as far as to say use plain old white distilled vinegar because you want a sharpness to this. So 3 tablespoons of oil, 3 tablespoons of vinegar, a clove of garlic, a big pinch of cayenne pepper, regular salt, regular black pepper, and you dredge your chicken in the usual, you know, flour, salt, pepper, fry it, and at the end, when it's almost done, you put in thick slices, like 1/2-inch thick slices of onion. Use at least one very large sweet onion, like a big Spanish onion, and throw those in between the pieces of chicken as they're frying. And when the chicken is done and the onion slices are fried, they won't get, some of it will get brown, but not necessarily all. Arrange the chicken and onion slices on the platter and pour over the vinaigrette. I remember loving this. And you let the chicken stand a few minutes in the vinaigrette. I think this recipe actually, Craig Claiborne loved it so much, it's in the International New York Times cookbook. But it's also in New York City Food, my opinionated history of New York City food. It now really is a history because that book ends in the late 1980s, early 90s. Hey, it's 30 years later. A lot has happened in New York, including Mexican food, real Mexican food. You can get real Mexican food down here.
Yeah, there used to be a time up here where we didn't have any Chinese restaurants up here. Then all of a sudden there was an influx. And one thing we do have now, because of the population that moved into the workforce, we do have a lot of great Mexican food that's made in our area, tamales and things
like that. Yes, because there are a lot of wonderful Mexican chefs.
Yeah.
And they're very open-minded. I know a few Mexican chefs. They are very open-minded. They don't even really want to cook Mexican food. They're way more interested in Italian food or Asian food. Yes, they're very sophisticated in a lot of ways. And by the way, Mexican food is very sophisticated too. So I don't know. Nowadays, I have to say, now that you can buy ground chicken and chicken parts and chicken boneless chicken thighs, that's a sort of new thing, at least in my life. I don't think we had boneless chicken thighs until 10 years ago. You can buy all these things in the supermarket now. And I don't often buy ground chicken. I do make some nice Japanese chicken balls, you know, meatballs cooked in broth. But I did run across, and I was going through my files of chicken recipes this morning, something that I really forgot about, and I'm going to do it again. I do think, I'm looking at the typeface that I wrote this in, which means it was for a book, but I don't think it ever made it into a book. And it's chicken patties a la vitello romano, meaning scallopini alla romana, meaning with sage and prosciutto. And you make these ground meat chicken patties using, I mean, ground chicken patties. Did I say that?
Yes.
And with bread to make them light. Four slices of white bread, a half a cup of milk. I'm looking at my recipe. 2 tablespoons of grated cheese, could be pecorino, could be parmigiano, whatever you have. An egg, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 teaspoon of pepper, 1/8 teaspoon of grated nutmeg. That's very good here. And you make these patties, and you wrap each of them with a leaf of sage on top, or two, one on either side, and wrap each piece in a slice of prosciutto, and then saute these in a pan, fry these in a pan, with butter. You don't need a lot of butter, especially if you use a no-stick pan. And it doesn't take more than 4 or 5 minutes on one side, and a couple, 3 minutes on the other side, and they're fully cooked. And it's very, very delicious. If I was eating mashed potatoes, I'd want this with mashed potatoes.
Mashed cauliflower. There you go.
Yeah. By the way, I was told this in Sheffield when I did my little presentation at the library. There were several people on the keto diet in the audience. And I knew this already, but let me say, if you want to make, because there are a lot of recipes out there, if you want to make good cauliflower mashed potatoes, steam the cauliflower while it is still hot. Put it in the food processor with a good amount of cream cheese. That's what does it, the cream cheese. So for my not very big head of cauliflower, I used about 3 tablespoons of cream cheese and 1 tablespoon of butter, and they were sensational. Salt and pepper.
All right.
So I could have that with there's nothing not keto about these patties. Yeah, I could do that. By the way, I've been cheating a little. And I've gained a little weight, but you know, it's what you get when you're not carb free.
All right, Arthur.
All right, well, have a great week, everybody. It's calm here, but very, very steely gray.
Well, it's steely gray and raining and sleeting and stuff like here, but it'll all pull out this afternoon and back to normal.
Yeah, well, what about tomorrow? Is it going to have rain tomorrow?
No, it's just going to be partly cloudy and temperatures in the 30s.
Okay, you're my best weatherman. You keep on top of this.
Yes, I have to.
My computer is less reliable. My phone is very reliable.
Yeah. All right.
Well, all right. Everybody, have a great week.
Okay, Arthur, take care.
Enjoy your chicken.
All right. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, this morning here on The Breakfast Club on Robin Hood Radio.
Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, Hillsdale Home Chef. More information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.